KALW.
And we have so many supports, and we don't punish people for needing things from other humans, but we do kind of punish and insult people for growing old.
A San Francisco doctor wants us to redefine aging.
We do have a lot of words, but nobody actually likes any of them, and that's about prejudice.
We hear from best-selling author and geriatrician Louise Aronson. Then the Golden Gate Park cast brings us a quixotic story that takes place at the ends of the earth.
So then they just stood as romantic pieces of art here at the west end of the park.
The story of the twin windmills at Golden Gate Park. And we'll hear a reading from a local author's new science fiction novel.
It's about two brothers who are forced into a struggle for power in an underground city.
That's coming up. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. You've probably heard the saying, it's all downhill from here once you reach a certain age. But that's not necessarily the case, according to Dr. Louise Aronson. She's a geriatrician at UCSF. Her best-selling book, Elderhood, was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize this year. In it, Dr. Aronson shares stories of treating older adults, and she explores why she thinks the healthcare system needs to do a better job at treating them. Aronson also writes about embracing aging and living a full life in our later years. KALW's Janae Darden chatted with Dr. Aronson for the Bay Area Book Festival's Unbound series. Here's an excerpt of their discussion.
Okay, the term elderhood, because there's so many terms to talk about older adults. Why elderhood?
Well, the whole point was it's a phase of life just like childhood and adulthood. So it's interesting, like with kids, yeah, you change a ton between birth and 20. And we have a lot of language for that. You know, you've got neonate, infant, toddler, kid, tween, teen, young adult, right? And it's been all of 20 years. But legally, we become elders at age 65. And the oldest patient I ever had was 111. The oldest person in the U.S. right now is 114. Now, those are exceptional, but there are a ton of centenarians. So that means elderhood lasts twice as long as childhood for a decent number of people. Mm-hmm. And we do have a lot of words, but nobody actually likes any of them, and that's about prejudice. So the other intent I had was to just kind of cool down the language. Like, this is just a life stage. It's like the other ones, not a big deal. Child, adult, elder, that's just life, and it is far better than dying young.
And I know you talked about in your book, or you wrote about an experiment a scholar did as far as looking at language, and it seemed like when they asked what comes to mind with old people, they had one kind of idea, and then it seemed like it was different when they said elder.
Yeah, it's interesting. And he's done this, the one I described is with medical students, but he's done it with tons of different people and people of all ages and backgrounds. And everybody for old, you know, gray and feeble and this, that, and the other, most pretty negative. And then for elder, it's like respect, power, responsibility, influence, wisdom, you know, it's good things. And the interesting thing about that is that if you look up the two words, I'm constantly looking up words, all the more since I read John McPhee's great draft number 4. I used to be a thesaurus person, but he changed me to a dictionary person.
Okay.
So they actually mean the same thing. So everything, you know, negative that we bring to old and all the positive to elder, that's all culture, you know, that's all prejudice. And that's good and bad. It's disappointing because we've done that to ourselves. Nobody wants to die and nobody wants to grow old. That puts us in a pretty tough spot. On the other hand, things that are cultural can change. And actually, you can see that how elders are doing in society has gone up and down throughout history and across cultures.
Mm-hmm. And before you became Dr. Aronson, what were your ideas of older adults? What would come to mind for you when you were growing up?
Oh, you know, I'm a pretty well acculturated American, so I didn't think much about it. You know, okay. I was a kid. What did it matter to me? I had a granddad I adored, who was just so much fun, a grandmother who was a little scarier. A great-grandmother who seemed like just really, really, really old, ancient to me, because she was in her 90s when I was little. So I had a sense that you changed, and also that being in your 90s was different than being in your 60s or 70s. But you just don't think about it. And unlike in school where I took a lot, I thought I was going to be a pediatrician actually when I went into medicine. And you can find tons of classes on kids and ways to volunteer and do things with kids and learn about kids and inspire kids. And there just wasn't as much for older adults. Now, some of that I like because older adults don't need that. Right. You know, I mean, many of them are, you know, just like adults. And that's something we don't tend to see. We tend to conflate the frail years with the decades of elderhood. Mm-hmm. And that actually is problematic. I think what people were talking about when they were using the word old were really the frail years. And does that happen if you don't die suddenly? It does. But we also make that as onerous as it is. Yes, of course, losing functions is difficult. It's disappointing. Mm. It can be frustrating. But there are other times in life where we have limitations, like if you're 9 months pregnant, or if you've broken a couple of limbs, or if you're a kid, and we have so many supports, and we don't sort of punish people for needing things from other humans, but we do kind of punish and insult people for growing old.
What is the upside to aging?
Well, there's this wonderful thing called the U-shaped curve of happiness, which
yes,
is
I've seen it.
I know, isn't that awesome?
Yeah.
And nobody knows. Like, it's crazy, but people are fairly happy as kids, and then it bottoms out in adulthood. Like, 40s and 50s, pretty heavy, stressful times. And then in your late 50s, things start improving. In your 60s, they get a lot better, and it goes on up from there.
Yeah.
Now, this is not in every single country. So if you look at the poorest countries in Asia or in Africa or in Latin America, if you're really impoverished and an average death rate is like in the 40s or something, you don't see that there.
Right.
But for most countries, you do see it. For the United States, you do see it. And you see it across, you know, geographic and other lines. Why is this? Well, part of it is that I think there's a certain release to the invisibility or to the physical changes. It's not that people don't try and look good, but there's less pressure because you're kind of like automatically off the, like, what the right thing, like where people stand when they win Miss America or, you know, whatever. Yeah. Like, you're just not in that context.
Right.
So you could still look good, but the pressures are a little different. There is just a comfort with self. And it's kind of knowing that more is behind you than ahead of you.
Right.
Better decisions. I can see that already in my career. There used to be things I would do out of sheer ambition or flattery. Mm-hmm. And now I'm like, no, you know, like things start happening to people in their 50s. I've got limited time. I'm going to do the things that I really believe in, that are going to make a difference in the world, and that I'm going to enjoy doing.
That was Dr. Louise Aronson, author of Elderhood, speaking with KELW's Janae Darden. They spoke at the Bay Area Book Festival, and you can watch the rest of their conversation at KELW.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. Now we're headed to the far west side of the Bay Area. We're concluding our journey through Golden Gate Park in one of KALW's original podcasts, the Golden Gate Park Cast. Today we'll hear the last episode for now. So let's head into the trees. When you're hanging out on the ocean end of the park, you'll often hear two things, birds and foghorns. It's wild and chilly. It's also easy and enjoyable to get off the beaten path here, to lose yourself in the forest in a good way. And those foghorns won't help you back here, but that's okay. This is a place to enjoy being away from it all. This is the Golden Gate Park Cast. I'm your host, Hanat Baba. Our destination today is at the southwest corner of the park, so let's get back on the street and make sure to avoid the many bicyclists. And watch out for those other two-wheeled vehicles. Soon enough, we head back into the trees. We reach a gravel path that takes us away from the road and... Can you hear it? Behind our walking, that background you hear is the sound of the ocean. We emerge to a wide open space of soccer fields. People have played here for a long time, and they used to play on grass, gopher holes and all. Then some years ago, the city voted to put up bright lights and lay down artificial turf. Now it looks kind of out of place in the wilds of the west end of the park, but it sure is popular. People from all over the city come here to play soccer. People of all ages, speaking different languages, they all come together for the most global sport. Such a great scene. We've still got today's destination ahead of us, so while this is fun, we gotta continue on. There it is. We can see it ahead of us now, rising up from the trees, wooden wings, an anomalous, anachronistic vision here at the end of the continent. It's a windmill. At the end of the 19th century, Golden Gate Park was just a few decades old. To irrigate it, engineers built a pair of towering giants, the Murphy windmill right in front of us and the Dutch windmill behind us. They'd harness the power of the ocean winds to pump water through the barren sand and nourish the verdant landscape. Over time, the windmills fell into disrepair and slowly disintegrated. But in the early 21st century, some visionary San Franciscans decided to rebuild the great windmills. We'll hear that story now from Neil Swinkles.
100 years ago, the Golden Gate Park windmills were the tallest man-made structures on the coast near San Francisco. They rose high above the newly planted trees like sentries, standing guard at the ocean's edge, their sails whooshing in the Pacific winds. Don Propstra, chairman of the Windmill Restoration Campaign.
The two windmills, both of these windmills, were very majestic and fully functioning. They're water mills, actually, and San Francisco giants, as they're called in the historic texts, and they actually did a lot of great work to irrigate this area for a number of years.
But just 14 years after they were built, electricity became the city's power of choice. Electric pumps irrigated Golden Gate Park, and the giants were made obsolete.
So then they just stood as romantic, whimsical pieces of art here at the west end of the park. The kind of harsh winds and weather conditions out here at the ocean's edge, you can imagine over the years, over 100 years now, because it was built in 1905, the west side of this windmill really took quite a battering.
In the 1980s, the Dutch windmill to the north was cosmetically restored. But there were not enough funds to also restore the southern windmill, better known as the Murphy windmill.
One more or two more winters of severe storms, this windmill would have toppled.
In 2002, the Murphy windmill was dismantled. So now, when you walk on the western edge of Golden Gate Park through gnarly, windswept trees and trails overgrown by weeds, you come upon what once was the mighty windmill, and...
All we've got is this cement stump of the south windmill.
Propstra, who is third-generation Dutch, launched a windmill campaign in the summer of 2000. After raising several million dollars through public and private funds, the Murphy windmill's cap and wings were sent away for repair to the Netherlands. Five and a half thousand miles away from Golden Gate Park, Lucas Verbeij directs his craftsmen in his windmill workshop in the Dutch town of Hoogmade. This is not your average workshop. It's a building the size of an airplane hangar, and it has to be this big because the windmill they are working on is enormous.
The cap is very, very heavy. It's about 16 metric tons. So I don't know how many pounds, maybe 140,000 pounds. It's the biggest windmill in the world. It's the biggest sailspan, 115 feet sailspan. So it's very, very big.
Verbeij is a fourth generation windmill builder, or millwright. His company is one of the few in the world that could take on a job of this scale.
There are 250 windmills in this area, so that's of course our main job.
Hoogmade is in a part of the Netherlands that lies more than 6 feet below sea level. These Western Dutch provinces were built on the power of the wind, and a quarter of the windmills that still remain can be found in this part of the country. Most of them date back to the 1700s and 1800s.
So when you look to the skyline of Amsterdam, Rotterdam, Schiedam, so the whole skyline was windmills in the old days.
Verbeij has restored and built windmills all over the world, but the Murphy windmill in San Francisco is his biggest job so far.
The windmill is not only work for me, it's also, it became a kind of hobby.
The nearly completed dome, which takes up almost half of Verbeij's building, measures roughly 40 by 60 feet and is 30 feet high. The wooden structure holds the cast iron gears and the main shaft, to which the gigantic sail stocks will be attached.
Well, the main shaft of the windmill is 14,000 metric tons, so that is about 30,000 pounds, a little bit more even. How could they get that lifted? I mean, now we order a crane and they bring, and then you need a huge crane.
In fact, the dome is so big and heavy that it only barely fits inside the building. It had to be placed directly on top of the pilings under the shop so it doesn't fall through the floor. During the restoration, Verbeij and his crew try to stay as close to the original plans as possible, avoiding mistakes from the past and using better materials when they can.
Yeah, we try to improve as much as possible. The sails, for example, were made by wood in the past, and we made steel sail stocks. And these steel sail stocks will last much longer than wooden ones.
Like a 60-ton jigsaw puzzle, the Murphy Dome will be taken apart, packed in containers and shipped from the Netherlands back to San Francisco, where Verbeij and a couple of his men will put it back together again. The whole process should take no more than 4 weeks, but all this cannot take place until local contractor Mark de Jong, a native Dutchman, has finished rebuilding the three-story tall wooden tower of the Murphy windmill.
You know, in America, they think a little bigger than Dutch people. You know, a Dutchman probably would have built four windmills. In America, they just built two large ones, which are the largest in the world.
De Jong walks among stacks of 30-foot-long wooden beams in a shed next to the Murphy windmill site. He says that even after many years of exposure to the elements, most of the wood used in the century-old windmill is still sturdy.
You know, part of the reason for that is the lumber they used was old growth lumber, like 300-year-old trees, which were cut at the end of the last century. And that the quality of that wood is just so amazing. And in fact, we have them here in the shed. You know, you can knock on it with a hammer and just hear the solid sound, like your hammer is still bouncing back. It's, you know, those are materials that are very hard to find. You know, so some of this lumber has been sitting exposed for all these years, and you know the quality of that old growth Douglas fir is just so good. It almost seems like it only gets better in time. It's like Dutch cheese.
The project is moving along slowly, and more money needs to be raised before the tower can be completed and the dome and sails returned. But Windmill Restoration Campaign Chairman Don Propstra is optimistic.
Right now it's just a bunch of overgrown brush. You've got a chain link fence around this south windmill. It's a pretty sober, stark sight. It's kind of takes a leap of imagination to picture this windmill being back functioning with sails and robustly working in the wind, and people going in and out of the Millwright House and enjoying the trail between the two windmills. But that won't be too far down the road.
That story was told by Neil Swinkles back in 2005. Now the Murphy Windmill stands complete, and on special occasions, the city ties its canvas sails to the wooden wings and lets them fly. That piece piece was part of our podcast made in honor of Golden Gate Park's 150th anniversary. You can subscribe to the Golden Gate Park cast to listen to every episode on the tour. Find it at klw.org/subscribe and on your favorite podcast player. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Bay Area authors have had to cancel launch parties and book tours because of the coronavirus, so we're bringing them to you in the series we're calling New Arrivals. Today, we hear from Juliette Wade, who lives in Newark. Her science fiction novel is called Mazes of Power. Here she is.
It's about two brothers who are forced into a struggle for power in an underground city. Here's a key passage. There was a scraping sound. Taggart dropped his hands into the water, fury rising as the handle of the locked door began to turn. "Nicanor," he bellowed, "don't come in here." Neck came in anyway. "Or what? You'll call the trashers up the chute to kidnap and incinerate me?" He was dressed to perfection in a pale brown day suit and had a horrible eager light in his eyes. "Have you heard the good news? The Speaker of the Cabinet just died of Kinder's fever. You know what that means, don't you?" Panic in the ballroom. A girl in a green dress. An Imbati bodyguard. A crazed man with a chair. Rain injured. Death stalking him in the bathtub. Taggart clenched his teeth. "I already know what it means." Neck might be 2 years younger, but he schemed like a 40-year-old politician. It means everything will change.
That was Newark-based author Juliette Wade reading from her new novel, Mazes of Power. You can find more information about that book and other recent releases at klw.org/newarrivals. And while you're there, why not subscribe to the Cross Currents newsletter and get all our stories delivered straight to your inbox. Today's Cross Currents team includes Vivian Bossieu-Skinner, Sarah Lee Sterland, Lisa Morehouse, and Marissa Ortega-Welch. Our engineers are James Rollins and Gabe Graben. Content manager is Shirin Adil. Our managing editor is David Boyer. News director is Ben Trefney. And our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Dawood Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.